after the latest news headlines with Richard Foster.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Thanks and good evening. Mohamed Al-Fayed was a monster whose behaviour was enabled by Harrods, the department store he owned. That's the claim from lawyers who represent some of the 37 women who've accused him of rape and sexual assault. The billionaire died last year, aged 94, and Harrods says it's now a very different company. Our correspondent Azadeh Moshiri has more.
The current owners and Harrods say they're utterly appalled by the allegations, that they apologise to the victims, and that they've set up a process that can quickly settle claims for the women should they want to avoid a lengthy legal process.
Mohamed Al-Fayed also owned Fulham Football Club between 1997 and 2013. It's investigating whether any women were abused there. 12 people have been killed and dozens more injured in an Israeli airstrike on the Lebanese capital Beirut. Israel says 10 Hezbollah commanders died. They're said to include Ibrahim Aqil. He was wanted by the US over two attacks in the 1980s, which killed hundreds of Americans. Our correspondent Hugo Bechega is in Beirut.
We know that there is a search operation. People are reported to be under the rubble. We've seen that there's some destruction, at least one building that's partially collapsed. At least, you know, the facade of the building has collapsed as a result of this airstrike.
The police watchdog has apologised for what have been described as abhorrent, degrading and cruel letters, which is sent to bereaved families and survivors of the Hillsborough disaster. The IOPC says it's extremely sorry for any distress the letters caused. Val Yates survived the disaster and received one of the letters. She's been speaking to Five Live.
They told me that there was no evidence that I'd seen a dead body. I don't know why they brought that into it, because they were scattered all over the pitch. It was one of the most traumatic things I've seen in my entire life. And to tell me that I didn't see it, because there's no evidence to support it, it's just like rubbishing my experiences.
Downing Street has confirmed that Keir Starmer, Angela Rayner and Rachel Reeves won't accept any donations for clothing in future. It follows the controversy for the Prime Minister after he accepted clothes from the Labour peer Lord Alley. The Food Standards Agency has warned people with a peanut allergy not to eat products containing mustard because they could have been contaminated. Around 50 products have already been recalled. And it's been confirmed that a tornado hit part of Aldershot in Hampshire this afternoon. Debris flew around in gardens, tiles were ripped off from roofs, several trees were brought down and two blocks of flats were hit, with a rooftop blown off.
You've probably got a list of things your child needs for uni. Pans, cutlery, sheets, duvet, towels, you know. But this is a little reminder that they'll also need a TV licence to be covered to watch all the TV channels, live TV on streaming services and BBC iPlayer. On the downside, it's one more thing on your list. On the upside, you can continue to enjoy your favourite shows together on the family group chat. And they won't be bringing it home to be washed either. To find out more, search TV licence uni.
Welcome along. I'm Reema Ahmed in for Stephen Nolan tonight. The lines are, of course, open for your calls. The big story of the day, then.
Mohamed Al-Fayed was a monster. He was a monster. But he was a monster enabled by a system. A system that pervaded Harrods.
Lawyers for the accusers of Mohamed Al-Fayed say it's time Harrods took responsibility. That's after allegations of sexual assault and rape against Fayed emerged this week. Tonight we'll hear from a former assistant to Harvey Weinstein. She says the law needs to change.
At the bottom of all of these issues are non-disclosure agreements. They are being used by every sector to hide information that is of public interest. And this is about the integrity of law. And the law is being made a fool of.
And later, the power of music to help people with dementia.
We're encouraging everyone to think about the soundtrack of their life and create a playlist today. So it's the songs that give you that flashback feeling, that remind you of special moments in your life. And music is so special. When you hear those songs, it's like a firework display of activity going off in the brain.
Michael Timmons there, the Executive Director of Playlist for Life. We'll hear more from him later. Let us know what song triggers huge memories for you. This is mine. All around the world, so many different girls in the clubs, yeah. And Gary's girls are so fine. I love this song so much. I am a garage girl at heart. This is Garage Girls Lonio, the Sunship Radio edit. Very niche, and yet I have played this at my graduation, every single birthday party I have ever had, and every good thing that has ever happened to me has been soundtracked by this song. It's a song that I would like to be played for me when I am old and grey. Tell me about the song that triggers those memories for you. Get in touch. The Nolan programme is all about your calls. Here's how you can get in touch.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Call free 08085 909 693. Text 85058. Texts will be charged at your standard message rate. Plus, see our privacy notice. bbc.co.uk/5live.
Now, as we came on air tonight, we've heard more on the accusations of sexual abuse against the billionaire owner of Harrods, Mohamed Al-Fayed, who also owned Fulham Football Club for 16 years. A former manager of Fulham's women's team has now said extra precautions were put in place to protect female players from the club's late owner. Throughout the day, we've been hearing more from the women who say they were abused by the billionaire owner. Lawyers representing women who've come forward say that 37 of them are now making allegations of abuse. It's after five women told a BBC investigation they'd been raped by Mohamed Al-Fayed when they worked at the luxury London department store. The legal team presented their case at a press conference this morning, and the King's Counsel, Dean Armstrong, laid out the case bluntly.
We will say it plainly. Mohamed Al-Fayed was a monster. He was a monster. But he was a monster enabled by a system. A system that pervaded Harrods.
Also speaking at the press conference, one of the survivors, Natasha, who was 19 when she started working for Mohamed Al-Fayed, she described being forced to undergo a medical exam.
I was subjected to an unnecessary and intrusive medical examination. I was never given those results. I was subjected to AIDS and STD testing without consent, and now believe in hindsight, I was checked for my purity. We would be sent to see Al-Fayed because he had a job for us to do. It was always more of a friendly chat than actual work. But then these private meetings turned into more. A forced kiss. His hands gripping your face to his lips or pulling you down on his lap where his hands were free to explore any part of your body that he wished.
Natasha told the press conference that Mohamed Al-Fayed went on to assault her.
He summoned me up to his private apartment on the pretext of a job review. I was escorted by one of his security guards who ushered me into his private sitting room. The door was locked behind me. Al-Fayed handed me a glass of champagne and told me to sit. Looking around, I saw his bedroom door partially open. There were sex toys on view. I felt petrified. I perched myself at the very end of the sofa. And then it came. Mohamed Al-Fayed, my boss, the person I work for, pushed himself onto me. I fell to the floor with him still on top of me, but I managed to kick free and free myself. I ran towards the door. I told him I was meeting my father for dinner and he would be worried that I was late. He just laughed at me. He then composed himself and he told me in no uncertain terms that I was never to breathe a word of this to anyone. If I did, I would never work in London again, and he knew where my family lived. I felt scared and sick. Eventually leaving Park Lane, I never set foot in his private office again.
Well, let's go straight to our correspondent, Laura Scott, who can tell us more about these allegations, especially as they pertain to Fulham Football Club. Laura, hello there. Tell us more about what has been suggested about the culture of the women's team with Mohamed Al-Fayed in charge.
Well, tonight I've been speaking to a former manager of Fulham Football Club's women's team, Gota Haugenes. He managed the team between 2001 and 2003, and he told me that the club put extra precautions in place to protect female players from the club's late owner, Mohamed Al-Fayed. He said that members of staff became aware that the late billionaire liked young blonde girls, and that as a result, players weren't allowed to be left alone with Al-Fayed, who owned the club for 16 years from 1997 to 2013. And we have heard from Fulham today. They issued a statement saying that they were deeply concerned by the disturbing reports about Al-Fayed that have come to light over the last 36 hours or so. And they said that they're in the process of trying to establish whether anyone at the club was affected and have encouraged anyone to come forward.
We don't know if any incidents took place at the club or involving anyone associated. But as you say, this will have to be investigated.
Absolutely. I think it's inevitable, given the scale of the accusations that have come to light about Al-Fayed's time at Harrods. It is inevitable that all of the other entities he was involved in would be looked into now. And that is clearly something that the lawyers representing the women who've already come forward accusing Al-Fayed of sexual abuse were keen to stress in a press conference today. They said that whilst they're currently not representing any women who previously worked here at Fulham, their investigations are ongoing. And they actually said in that press conference, wherever Al-Fayed went, there will be victims. So we know that the club are now actively trying to see if anyone was involved, and those lawyers as well.
Thank you very much, Laura Scott, with the latest there. That is brand new as we came on air tonight, news that we've heard more on the accusations of sexual abuse against the billionaire owner of Harrods, Mohamed Al-Fayed, who also owned Fulham Football Club. The women's team has now said they had extra precautions put in place for when he was around. Tom Bauer wrote Fayed, the unauthorised biography, in 1998. He's with me now. Hello, Tom.
Hello, good evening.
Hearing all of that, what do you make of this?
Well, I must tell you, this was all known 30 years ago. And I have been for 30 years amazed how everyone ignored the evidence all these years.
Was it in your book? Did you write about this?
Absolutely, absolutely. It was all in the book. And it's been repeated, and when he died, the BBC treated him as a hero, and a year later, he's suddenly the villain. And I must say, the lawyers, I think, as well, it's a bit odd saying, accusing Harrods. I mean, Harrods was Fayed. He ran it. He owned it. The idea there was a separate entity between Harrods and Fayed is ridiculous.
But there were other people around him, people in positions of power that could have held him to account.
There were other people. They weren't in positions of power. They were Fayed's employees, and they did what he demanded. And if they didn't do what he demanded, they were lucky to just depart. But invariably, he put trumped up charges to make their departure painful and expensive. I mean, he was a tyrant. He was a lying fantasist tyrant, and a monster is accurate. But everyone knew. Who knew the story of Fayed on the inside knew he was a monster in his lifetime.
So,
the trouble is, he was protected.
I'm interested, Tom, when you wrote that book in 1998 and you put these things in the book, we're going to be talking a little bit later in the programme about NDAs, about the lawyers, about how no one could cross Fayed. How did you cross Fayed to get this book published?
Well, because it was the truth, and he threatened to sue and then pulled back because he didn't want to appear in the witness box. And the only way, the reason that NDAs, these non-disclosure agreements, have value is because the courts, the judges, are totally unwilling to strike people like Fayed down and protect people who are telling the truth. It's the courts, the judges, the lawyers who are to blame. They make a fortune by suppressing the truth. And that is part of the problem why Fayed got away with it. And, of course, he got away with it as well, because he had a very, very ruthless, dangerous policeman called John McNamara, a former Scotland Yard chief superintendent, as his security officer. And McNamara either personally threatened people or got the police, Scotland Yard policeman, to turn a blind eye or to do his bidding. Well, I mean, he did it against me too.
There's going to be, clearly, there needs to be a massive investigation launched, not only into the culture at Harrods, not only into who knew about this and who allowed it to happen, but also, you know, Fulham Football Club now as well. Aside from you know, all of that that is happening now, back when you wrote your book, did you speak to him? What was he like as a person with the level of influence that he had in high society?
Well, I knew Fayed very well because I'd written previously a biography of his great enemy, a man called Tiny Rowland, who actually owned a lot of the Harrods shares and was aiming and wanting to own Harrods. And the story is a bit complicated, but in a nutshell, Fayed got hold of the shares and bought Harrods using the money of the Sultan of Brunei, which drove Tiny mad. And Fayed loved the book because I described, and Rowland, who was equally criminal, in ways that Fayed liked. So I met him quite a lot. And then the height of my close relationship, so to speak, with Fayed was that when Diana died, the following day I went on Fayed's helicopter with McNamara, with a pathologist and the head of his legal team to Paris on Fayed's helicopter and interviewed all the people in the Ritz who'd been with Diana and Dodi 24 hours beforehand. And that story itself is obviously fascinating. But it was at that stage, when I was in the Ritz for 12 hours, that I realized that Fayed was not the very generous human being I thought he was, but he actually was a monster, and he was bugging me and threatening me, and in the end was surrounded by these armed guards. And I realized that the man to write about was Fayed himself, and that of course was the beginning of the souring of my relationship with Fayed. Now, you ask what sort of man he was. Well, beyond the jester, the life and soul of the party, was a very nasty criminal, a thief, a brazen liar, a man who not only raped women, but also destroyed reputations. And he was a man, in a personal level, a man who obviously corrupted politicians, constantly giving out wadges of power, 500 franc notes or 550 pound notes, whatever, not only to British politicians, but also the mayor of Paris and others.
What's interesting about all of this, Tom, you know, listening to this, is that, you know, if this was known by high society and it was known by the people who were around him and it was known by the people that he came into contact with and it was known by the people who he worked with, how has this not made its way into the public consciousness? We've seen, you know, The Crown, the you know, that famous TV show that, you know, portrayed him as well last year or the year, or, you know, over the last few years. How has this not come out? How did we not know this sooner?
Well, you know, I could give you lots of reasons and lots of examples, not least that the BBC itself refused to do a proper programme about Fayed. I can assure you there are many times when I was asked, will I help make a programme for the BBC, and I worked for the BBC for 26 years in panorama documentaries. I know how to make a film. The BBC refused to touch it, and part of the reason was that they feared libel writs, and he was a very, very ruthless litigant. But also, they fear telling the truth. He frightened people. You know, when I was writing his biography, I was told by someone who actually knew that McNamara was looking for someone to break my fingers so I couldn't type. You know, McNamara tried to entrap me in a crime and had police waiting to arrest me when I did, he thought I'd do something foolish because he set it all up. I mean, this was a man who was a gangster. And the trouble is, the police were on his payroll.
So fear is what you are saying, Tom Bauer. I'm hearing is fear is the reason why we didn't hear from this. People were afraid of Fayed as a man and what he was capable of. It's fascinating stuff. And Tom, thank you for being with us. Tom Bauer there, who wrote that biography, the unauthorised biography in 1998, saying he knew at the time The big question is, why didn't anyone else? Why did this not trickle down and make it to the public? Let's hear a bit more on this from a legal perspective, though. Jessica Wilson is a senior lawyer and a specialist in sexual offences at Ventum Legal in Manchester. Hello, Jessica.
Hi there. Good evening.
Thank you for being with us. What are your thoughts on the accusations against Mohamed Al-Fayed? And what's the likely outcome of this kind of case when we have a dead defendant?
Well, yeah, like I'm coming into this from a criminal law point of view. I mean, much of the discussion is around the NDAs and that falls under employment and contract law. From a criminal point of view, the Crown Prosecution Service, the body responsible for bringing these types of cases to the courts, that they won't prosecute someone who is deceased. But as we were saying there, and Tom made mention of some other people that were potentially aware and involved in what was going on here, whether the CPS and the police open up an investigation into others, other workers at Harrods who were potentially enabling this behaviour, I don't know, but it's a potential possibility.
Mm. Well, we had that barrister who mentioned that wherever Fayed went, there will be this sort of, you know, these sort of stories that will have followed him around. Mm-hmm. When we look at how these sexual offences are handled in the legal system, have things changed much in recent years at all? Because I'm guessing that one of the big reasons why these women didn't come out before was that they just didn't believe that the justice system was on their side.
Well, of course, yeah. And some of these complaints are going back to the late 1980s and 2000s. And the laws in relation to rape and sexual assault have hugely changed. There's a massive sort of push for more prosecutions now. There's lots of money that has been put into the Rape and Serious Sexual Offences Unit, the RASO unit at the CPS. Last year, Operation Soteria was launched across police forces and CPS departments, and that has changed to the way in which the CPS and the police respond to sexual assault cases. So there's more money going into it, and there is more support and training as well to legal professionals, barristers, prosecutors, and the police. There's more support and training given to them, which has helped.
Is it worth it though for women to come forward? Because we see time and time again that, you know, and it doesn't always have to be a powerful, famous person who is the perpetrator, could be anyone. What we end up seeing is, you know, the woman being the centre of the case. What we end up seeing is that it's, you know, her name who is dragged through the mud, or whoever, you know, the victim is. They might be a he. It feels from the outside looking in, I'm sure for many people, would think, why would I put myself through that?
Yeah, no, I can understand. I can understand why people have that thought process. And, you know, for the millions of women and men that go through these types of cases and are victims of this, we've got to remember as well that there's hundreds of thousands of people out there who are falsely accused of these types of offences as well. So it's not only the victim or the complainant's name that's dragged through these types of cases and lengthy court proceedings and police investigations. It's also the suspect and the defendant that is dragged through that. I mean, I represent many men and women accused of sexual assault, and I've come across many cases where it's become apparent that it is a false allegation, and there's, you know, you can never say why people will say things like this and come across with false allegations to the police. But it does happen, and we have to be alive to that fact as well.
Jessica Wilson, thank you for joining us this evening, senior lawyer and specialist in sexual offences. Well, my next guest, Zelda Perkins, was instrumental in bringing the sexual abuse claims about Harvey Weinstein to light, ultimately leading to his conviction. In 1998, she exposed Weinstein's behaviour to his company, Miramax, but she was prohibited from talking about it after signing a non-disclosure agreement, or NDA, until she broke it in 2017. Since then, she co-founded the organisation Can't Buy My Silence, and just before we came on air, I asked her what she thought about these new allegations against Mohamed Al-Fayed.
Well, sadly, it's completely unsurprising. And I mean, the documentaries was utterly horrifying and, a very, very uncomfortable and unpleasant watch. And it breaks my heart because I've been speaking about this issue for nearly 7 years now. And the reality is that nothing seismic enough has changed with legislation or with legal sector regulators to stop this.
So how do we change the law to stop people being abused by powerful people? How do we do that?
Well, there are several routes into this, and both the Conservative government and the current Labour government are looking at ways and of doing this, but not fast enough. The Workers' Protection Bill, which is on the table at the moment, is an obvious way in to protect employees. And obviously this would be a great way to protect employees because it's not just protecting women, it's protecting everybody. And you would hope that this would protect people from discrimination and other forms of misconduct, not just sexual assault and misconduct, because that is just the tip of the iceberg. Ultimately, the Human Rights, the Equality Act is where real change should happen. Mm. But realistically, at the moment, with what's on the table, it's the Workers' Protection Act. I know this morning there have been some announcements by Labour with regard to, more gender-based violence issues. But I think in terms of the workplace, which is the most prevalent arena where that huge power disparity is so apparent, that any form of employee rights being firmed up would be the best way forward.
I think the big issue with that, which you know, Zelda, having been raising public awareness of this for so long, is that there isn't any sort of a move at the moment to make that the reality when it comes to NDAs and when it comes to employment protections.
Well, it should be, and I have very high hopes for this new government. We managed to get through some legislation via the Ministry of Justice just before the election, which has made NDAs void in cases of criminal activity, if they're covering up criminal activity. Now, I mean, that sounds ridiculous because you'd have thought that would be the case anyway. And it is the case legally anyway. But unfortunately, people don't know that. And the fear that NDAs and the and lawyers and the legal sector can put on victims is so enormous
that
they don't
know
their rights.
A really great point, because I think to the average person on the street, when you say the word NDA, that is a scary legal document, which if you ever have to sign one is probably bad news, and you would never, ever do anything to breach it, right? Because we've seen all the legal dramas, we've seen what happens to the everyday average person when they have to sign an NDA. And I think that is maybe a huge thing when it comes to public perception, public consciousness. And when something goes wrong, like in this case, like with Weinstein, there are, victims of abuse who just feel like there is nothing to be done.
Exactly. And all you have to do actually is look at the last 5 or 6 scandals in the last sort of 12 to 18 months, whether it's the post office scandal, whether it's the CBI, whether it's, Epstein, Weinstein, whatever you want to look at, there are NDAs at the bottom of that trail every single time. And people's knowledge of NDAs is very limited. And that's one of the things that we're trying to do hugely with the campaign Can't Buy My Silence, is give people that information, because that information is power. But unfortunately, until the law sector takes some responsibility for their part in this, things aren't really going to change. It should not be an option for a lawyer to make a legally enforceable agreement, which is stopping somebody taking their voice away, which is a basic human right, when there are allegations of serious misconduct.
I really wanted to ask you, Zelda, while you were here, because I think you are probably one of the very few people on earth who would have, the sort of access to a powerful, powerful person like Al-Fayed, like Weinstein. What is it like being in proximity to a person like that, to a man like that, especially when you know that there is a very dark side to them?
Well, there's two parts to that question, or to that answer. Being around somebody that powerful, which you know, is something that isn't talked about enough, is intoxicating and exciting. You're in the lion's den, in a way, which is the dangerous part, but there is a huge amount of excitement and thrill to be in the trust of somebody powerful. And, you know, that plays into our societal and cultural makeup. And actually part of the problem is our sycophancy to power and fame, because this is what puts people into such a vulnerable position. I think there's also a big issue about women and the gender issue of women and women being allowed to be ambitious, or the vulnerabilities that women have that men don't have if they want to move forward within a working environment. You know, a lot has changed in the last 7 years in terms of how we talk about, you know, the discourse in the workplace, but it really was not unusual. And I think you see even in the documentary on Fayed that it was quite normal that everybody was like, oh yeah, well, she'll get a promotion because she's been in with Fayed, or she'll get a promotion. You know, that was part of the kind of natural, normal narrative that women were going to be expected to give some sort of favour to move forward in work, and that their ambition was preyed on. And I think that's a terrible, terrible legacy that women have had to carry for many, many, many years in the workplace.
Like you say, there's a few complex threads to it, because there's obviously the gendered element, as you say, we know that, we have seen that for decades throughout history, but also this thing of being close to power and that being intoxicating. Do you think in that situation, and I'm not talking about those victims who were abused here, I want that to be really clear, I'm talking about people who maybe looked the other way while these men were committing these crimes, let's call them what they are, against women. Do you think there was an element of, this man trusts me and he's very powerful and I will do what it takes to protect him because that is good for me?
Absolutely. But you also have to remember, as you say, the complexity of those relationships, because that powerful man also holds the purse strings and the future of your life in his hands, because it's not just about losing a job when you work for somebody that powerful, as Fayed made very clear, and as Weinstein also did. You know, if you crossed them, they would not just fire you, they would ruin your lives. And, you know, my life and my colleague's life and many lives of women who crossed Weinstein's lives were ruined, as were, as we can see, the women who defied Fayed.
Zelda, I did want to ask you about the Fayed documentary that came out and what you made, speaking of NDAs, of Harrods saying, you know, we weren't aware at the time, we didn't know what was going on. And then sort of, you know, in the next minute, people saying everyone knew and this was the culture at the time. What do you make of that? How do we detangle that?
That's very complex. I mean, you know, Fayed sold Harrods, I think, 10 years ago. So the turnover of senior staff, I mean, I have no idea what the makeup of that company is. And a lot of the people who were aware of the rumour or were seeing kind of the outer edges of what were going on, some of them spoke on the documentary, which I think was very commendable. But I think it's very difficult to hold just to hold Harrods itself to account. You know, this is a much bigger, broader issue. And, you know, when you watch the press conference earlier today, with all of those lawyers, particularly Gloria Allred, talking about, you know, these clear patterns that were emerging, and these clear themes that are emerging from all of these cases, what she didn't acknowledge, and nor did any of the other lawyers there, and I'm not trying to have a pop at them, because what they're doing is incredibly important and commendable, but the legal sector is not acknowledging its own role in the enablement of these powerful people. If the law was not viable, you know, these lawyers benefit from these big NDAs. They have skin in the game. Now, in the UK, the LSB, the Legal Standards Board, and the SRA, and the Law Society, and the Bar have all come to the conclusion that NDAs are being misused. They've put out multiple warning notices. But this is not changing the culture. This is not changing guidance. It should not be an option for a solicitor or a lawyer to make an agreement that is hiding potential criminal behaviour. Non-disclosure is for protection of intellectual property and trade secrets. Abusing and raping your staff is not a trade secret.
Zelda Perkins joining me earlier, talking about NDAs and how they were used when it comes to this particular case. Tim in Marlow has just been in touch saying an NDA is not inevitably a bad thing. Hundreds of thousands are signed every day around the world to protect intellectual property, confidential information and so on. It really would be helpful to make this point because there is a real risk of demonising a perfectly normal and vitally important legal document. I think that was covered there just at the end. By Zelda. And I think there's a distinction to make between when an NDA is used for, you know, trade secrets and for confidential information, and then when it sort of crosses a line into something else. I think that's the conversation there, Tim. Thank you for your message, though. Just coming up to 10:35 on a Friday night. It is Reema Ahmed in for Stephen Nolan, and it's time for your headlines with Shabnam Yunusjul.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Reema, thank you. Good evening. More than 100 women have now contacted lawyers accusing Mohamed Al-Fayed of sexual assault. The former Harrods owner has been described as a monster and a predator by lawyers representing some of them. Harrods insists the company is very different now and a process is available to women who say they were attacked by Mr. Al-Fayed. 12 people have been killed and dozens injured in an Israeli airstrike on the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Israel says 10 Hezbollah commanders died. They're said to include Ibrahim Akil, who was wanted by the US over two attacks in the 1980s, which killed hundreds of Americans. The US Secret Service has published an interim review of the failures that led to the attempted assassination of Donald Trump at a rally in Pennsylvania in July. Poor planning and a communication breakdown were among the lapses identified. And the actor David Graham, who was best known for voicing the chauffeur Parker in the original series of Thunderbirds, has died at age 99. He was also the evil Dalek's voice in Doctor Who in the early 1960s and more recently Grandpa Pig in Peppa Pig. In sport, defending champions Chelsea kicked off the new Women's Super League season under new manager Sonia Bonpastor with a 1-0 win against Aston Villa. Johanna Rytting-Kanyed scored the goal. Chelsea are aiming for a sixth WSL title in a row this year, but a first without former boss Emma Hayes. Motherwell reached the Scottish League Cup semi-finals for the first time in 6 years after a 2-1 win over Dundee United. In the Championship, Hull City stunned Stoke 3-1 away to get their first win under manager Tim Walter. Rugby Union's new Premiership season got underway with Bath avenging their final defeat to Northampton Saints by scoring 5 tries to win 38-16, while Bristol Bears beat Newcastle 24-3. Hull KR finished second in Super League after a 26-16 win over Leeds. Warrington and Lee also finished the campaign with wins. Anthony Joshua weighed in heaviest ahead of Saturday night's world title challenge against Daniel Dubois. The two-time unified heavyweight champion tipped the scales at 18 stones. That's 4 pounds heavier than his opponent, who holds the IBF belt. And you can hear that fight here on 5 Live and BBC Sounds from 8:30 tomorrow night. And in golf, England's Matt Baldwin will take a 2-shot lead into the third round of the PGA Championship after equaling the tournament record over the first two rounds at Wentworth. He's on 13 under with Rory McIlroy tied fourth on 9 under.
This is 5 Live Sport.
Hello there. Good evening. It is Reema in for Stephen tonight. Get in touch with the programme. Call 08085 909 693 or you can text as well 85058. I'm asking you for the song which would appear on your playlist for life and why, as later this evening we'll be talking about the impacts of playing playlists of favourite songs to help people who have dementia. It's a great, lovely thing. Paul from Southport's been in touch. Paul says, Reema, I really like you on the radio. Your five is in the post, Paul. He says, one of my favourite all-time songs is Bronski Beat, Small Town Boy. Jimmy Somerville lyrics about being different really mirrored my own feelings and emotions and gave me the strength to come out as bisexual last year. Congratulations, Paul. That is the power of music, isn't it? That is what music can do for us. It can make us brave. It can make us remember better times. It can help us reflect on times that weren't so good. What I want from you is just one song that would appear on your playlist and the reason why. The why is important there. Thank you, Paul, for getting in touch tonight. Now, students should face higher university fees to tackle a funding black hole in the sector. That's according to the President of Universities UK, Professor Dame Sally Mapstone. Since 2017, tuition fees for students in England have capped at £9,250 per year. Quite eye-watering. Universities UK has said that fees should rise in line with inflation as well as more government investment. If fees had stayed in line with inflation, they'd now be in the region of £12,000 to £13,000 per year. Professor Sally Mapstone was on Radio 4's Today programme.
I don't think that we should consider a straight trade-off between the Russell Group or Oxbridge and other universities. If we look at non-Russell Group universities, they are training about 90% of our teachers, people working in nursing and so forth, all occupations which are really essential to the new government's plans for growth and the extension of the skills market. So this should not be seen as some kind of arms race. We have regulation which ensures that universities are held to account for the quality and the value of the degrees that they produce.
In England and Wales, the cost is borne predominantly by the student. In Scotland, it's borne by the state. So let us know what you think tonight. Do you think, as a student, graduate, or parent of a student or graduate, that you're getting value for money from your degree? Well, a few years ago, Martin Lewis from Money Saving Expert was on Five Live with an interesting perspective on degrees and debt.
It's still worth noting that those who go to university have higher average incomes afterwards and often easily the time they took out from work and the amount that they pay back for their university degree and maintenance loan is easily superseded by the increased earnings they have. But that is not a universal truth. And I absolutely think it's right in this age of apprenticeships and other jobs that for some people, university is not the best option. But I am still a huge supporter of a university education for many careers. And for many people, it's right for. And I don't believe we should frame it as a debt. If we look at the situation that applies now for students in England who go to university, it is a financial no-win, no-fee system. You repay once you leave in proportion to what you earn for 30 years. It's effectively a graduate tax. It isn't cheap, but it's not a debt. It's a 9% increased form of taxation from around £26,000. So if you earn a lot, it's going to cost you a lot. If you earn a little, it won't cost you much at all. My hope is university education will cost the people who go for it for financial reasons a shed load, because it means they're earning a shed load.
Martin Lewis's take on the financials as a student. Well, joining me now is Vice-Chancellor of the University of Portsmouth, Professor Graham Galbraith, along with Oliver Middleton, a third-year Politics and International Relations student at the University of Chichester, and David Hammond, who studied for his BA in Germany and a Master's in England. Welcome, all of you, to the programme this evening.
Hello, thank you.
Hello.
Hello there. I'm going to start with you, Graham. What is the biggest challenge right now that university finances are facing?
Well, I just think, like everyone else in the economy, the large amount of inflation, the costs of heating, the costs of lighting, the costs of academic journals and books has gone up beyond inflation, actually, in the last few years. Naturally, costs are rising. It's very, very difficult when your income per student has been the same for the last 10 years. I don't think there's many situations where you can think of a product or a service where there has been no increasing cost for almost a decade. And the challenge then for universities is, how do we balance our books? How do we provide the amazing high quality education that the UK is renowned for in a situation where the value of the money we receive is going down and down every single year? It's not sustainable in the long term.
But is it sustainable to keep charging students more for the education that they are receiving? Because, the argument is no.
Well, the issue there, of course, is that everything is going up in price, as we know. But of course, the decision about how you fund higher education is not one that is in the hands of vice chancellors. That is a government decision. And, you know, our observation is that if we are not paid the amount of money that is reasonable to give the student the education that they deserve, then it will be pretty catastrophic for some universities and for the quality of higher education in the United Kingdom. How the government chooses to properly fund higher education is a political decision. And I think the comment wasn't that vice chancellors want the fee to rise. The comment was that the real cost is near £12,000 to £13,000, but we are only receiving funding very much less than that. And so, of course, the only way that we can provide high quality education is by using income from other means, such as international students, in order to pay for the education of home students. And that doesn't sound like a satisfactory situation.
Where there's been a drop, though, as well. You know, there's fewer international students coming because, you know, why would they come to the UK if they can, if, you know, if they can't bring their family, for example?
Indeed. And that is a challenge that universities are facing. And that, of course, is adding to the financial situation at many universities up and down the country. And universities that are very dependent on the fees for international students, of course, that then in the long term might make it very difficult for them to continue to operate the way they do.
Well, there'll be people listening, Graham, there'll be people listening going, well, actually, hang on a second, where is the money being spent then at these universities? If you've got each student paying, you know, just under 10 grand per year, you've got on top of that the, you know, international students that you do have, you've got this other funding that is coming in. Surely that should be enough to cover all of this. You know, where is this money going?
Yeah, so it's interesting because that's a question then that you might ask any organisation up and down the UK. You know, why have you increased your prices at all in the last 10 years? Is it possible for the prices to stay the same forever? Would we not expect that as the value of money changes and that as inflation takes place, that
it's not the same as it's not the same as going to a supermarket, though, is it, Graham, going to get your degree?
It's absolutely not. It's much more important than going to a supermarket, actually, because it has a huge transformational effect in people's lives. And I think, unfortunately, the language that we use to consider higher education should be a language around investment. Investment in higher education brings a return, as you heard earlier in the little piece that you played. The fact is that it is an investment in individuals' future, and it is a very positive investment in people's future, and it's a positive investment for the government. The reality is that for every pound of public money that the government spends in UK universities, the London Economics Report recently demonstrated that there's a £14 economic benefit for the country. So it's not just about the benefit to the individual, it's also about the benefit to the communities where universities reside and to the wider economic success of the United Kingdom.
Well, I'm going to go to Oliver here, who's a third year politics and international relations student. Oliver, what do you make of that?
I'm more sympathetic to the argument that tuition fees need to go up than you might think, because I get at the end of the day, universities are having to do more with less, especially over the COVID period where inflation has skyrocketed, meaning prices for basic necessities have increased. But I fear that the tuition fee rise is going to be brought all on the students. And I don't think that that is an acceptable way of going about it. I feel like the government really needs to intervene here.
So wait, hang on. You're in favour of tuition fees rising or not?
Yes, I'm in favour of it.
And so in terms of your tuition fees, are you, have you got the loan? Are you on a, you know, have you applied for all of that? Yeah, and you're going to be paying that back when you're in work after you leave, Oliver?
Yeah.
And is that the case for a lot of your friends? Do you know anyone that's able to pay these fees up front?
I really couldn't know. I couldn't tell you anyone that I know that pays these fees up front, I'll be honest.
In terms of the value that you get for the money then that you're paying, do you think it's good value? Do you think that you are getting a world-class education?
Well, I'll part of the reason why I'm in favour of a tuition fee rise is because I have noticed a steady decrease in the performance of my specific university, and they've had to cut back, especially on humanities degrees, which perhaps aren't gaining as many new students. And so, you know, I've noticed a decrease in my educational value, as perhaps I, in the first year, I was a lot more sort of happy with my university education than perhaps I am going into my third year sort of thing, because I've noticed the cutbacks firsthand, which is why I am in favour of tuition fee rises.
David Harmon is with us as well. David, you studied in Germany and the UK. How do those experiences compare?
That's right. Well, those are two very different experiences in terms of the burden that was placed on me as a student. And I still carry the financial burden of my education in the UK. My education in Germany was supported by the state. The quality of the education was the same. In fact, in terms of critical thinking, and I think critical thinking is what our societies need and the British economy needs moving forwards, the education in Germany was slightly better. And there the culture is this recognition of exactly the point that, that Graham made. And I think Graham very clearly laid out the problems that are facing the sector. Nobody should be denying that the sector needs more money, but the it's an investment, and the returns on that investment come for the economy.
I think the glaring observation here is that this ends up affecting working class kids, basically. Exactly. Kids from poorer backgrounds who looking, and I, you know, I know kids over the last few years who said that they wanted to go to university, and just the thought of taking out a loan and the thought of being in debt by that much just wasn't something that they were willing to do to go to university. This is stopping.
Exactly right.
This is stopping some students who could be really capable and who deserve, you know, a higher education in lots of ways, to just to not make the decision based on financial, their financial situation.
Rima, if I can just make a comment about that. I mean, when the great thing about the loan system, and I do accept what you're saying, but the great thing about the loan system is someone doesn't need to be rich to go, because actually the fee is paid up front and the individual only pays back when they get the benefit from higher education.
Yes.
Well, Graham, now,
That's really important. But what I do accept is that there is an issue, an emerging issue, in relation to the maintenance costs for students when at university, because the maintenance loans have also not kept up with inflation. And in fact, the previous government removed the maintenance grants that were available. In other words, it wasn't a loan, it was a money you got to help you, and that was removed from the very poorest of students. And I think if we can do something about maintenance grants, that to me is the biggest barrier for young people from working class backgrounds to get university.
And David, what were you going to say there?
Well, I would like to challenge Graham actually on the idea that the loan system makes provides a situation where anybody wants to go to university. Anybody sees that as a worthwhile and possible investment, because that's simply not the case. For somebody from an economically disadvantaged background, the idea of taking on £100,000 in debt in this environment where we have all recognized pressures on the individual are increasing and these people will not have wealthy families to fall back on is massively different to somebody who comes from a wealthy background, is used to economic security, and is confident that they will be able to pay off that loan. And I would, I think actually that is the way that university education is disincentivized for people from lower income backgrounds. Well, once they do make that decision to move into the system, the loan system that we currently have further advantages the people who are the wealthiest afterwards, because they are the people who will be able to pay off those loans and then take all of their income, which would be significantly higher, and keep all of that. Whereas the majority of people, and until a couple of years ago, only one quarter of people were expected to pay off their loans before they were written off. All of those people, the middle earners would be burdened with a tax for their entire working life.
I'm just going to ask Oliver, what do you make of the fact that you will have this loan to pay back after you are finished with your studies? Is it something that you think about? Is it something that you give any thought?
It is slightly concerning because, like has been already said, it's literally a tax on what you earn. As I think Martin Lewis said 9%. And so, you know, if that tax was removed, we'd be able to spend 9% on the economy rather than just giving directly back to the government, which I think would boost the economy. So I don't know. It's not something that I think about every day, but it's not something that isn't prescient.
Graham, you know, we're talking about the financials here, and I understand that this is, you know, at the core of keeping a lot of these universities open and running. I understand that. But is there a big concern about the types of student you start getting, you know, en masse when you raise fees? Because you are going to see less diversity in all areas, really, aren't you?
Well, the University of Portsmouth is a widening participation institution. So at the core of our mission is making sure that anyone who can benefit from higher education can go and get the benefit of it. And we have a large group of students who come from a whole variety of different backgrounds. I think the interesting thing in relation, and I do understand the point that was made about the perception of a large debt, but it really is important, as Martin Lewis has said often, to make sure that people realise it is about an additional tax. I think what's interesting is the previous government last year changed the loan plan and they moved into what's called Plan 5 of the loan system. And what they actually did was they changed the payback regime. And that has had a huge impact on what individuals pay back, because previously, the more you earned, the more you paid back. Under Plan 5, actually, it flattens out the payback so that the very richest pay back about the same as the people at the lower end. And this Loan 5 was never discussed. It was never debated. It meant the students pay back for 40 years now rather than 30 years when it's written off. And interestingly, when you look at what the government contribution now in the UK is to higher education, the expected contribution from the individual is estimated at about 90%. The contribution from the government is now down to about 10%. And I think there's a real question to be asked about what is the right balance of contribution. We know that having graduates improves the economics of the country. So the country should be paying, I think, more, in my view, but that is a political decision.
David, listening to that, and, you know, with your experience in studying here at home in the UK and abroad, when it comes to what Martin Lewis said that we heard in that clip that we played of him earlier, he mentioned that the loan is, he mentioned the phrase, it's no win, no fee. So basically, if you don't make the amount of money, you know, that you think you might earn after making a degree, then you won't have to pay back as much. What's your take on that? Because it's still, you know, for a lot of people, that still seems like a two-tier system whereby if you've got rich mummy and daddy, they can pay up front and then you can take your entire paycheck home at the end of the day when you do start making money. And if you don't, then there's just more money coming out of your paycheck at the end of every month for the rest of your life, pretty much.
That's exactly right. And I think Martin Lewis also said that it's not like a debt. Well, it certainly feels like a debt, and it feels like a debt that you have to repay alongside all of the other rising costs in life. Students that come out of university and start earning, I think the boundary is £26,000. If you're living in London, I live in London, £26,000 is nothing. You can't survive. You can't live a decent life on that. And if you then start having to pay back your loan at that rate, that feels like a debt. In fact, it is a debt that has to be repaid. It's not no win, no fee. You might be able to look back on your life when you're 60 and think that that was a worthwhile investment. But when you are 25 years old and you are repaying that loan, it's exactly what it is. It's a loan.
Just before we go to the news here, gentlemen, just like one line from each of you. Graham, how would you encourage someone who's on the fence financially about university to go to university, just very quickly?
Going to university is an investment in your future. It's an investment in your future earnings. And all the evidence suggests that it's a very good investment for the individual and it's a good investment for government.
Oliver?
I'd take a slightly different tack. I think it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that you shouldn't pass up on because you'll get experiences like no other.
And David?
You should absolutely go to the university and invest in your own future and invest in the economy. But we need to look to our leaders before we go to university. Leaders like Graham, whose job it is to advocate for a system that is not broken. System's currently broken. Let's not lean further into it and burden students more. Let's change the system. Graham, it's your job to do that.
Professor Graham Galbraith, Oliver Middleton, who's a third-year student, and David Harmon, who studied both here in the UK and in Germany as well. What are your takes on this? Are you paying back a student loan? Can you really feel it? Do you feel it when that goes out of your paycheck? Are you the parent of a student or a graduate? What was that like? And, you know, in this sort of economy, if you were looking to apply to university, knowing that you were going to pay just under 10 grand per year to go, would you apply? Big questions. We are coming up to 11 p.m. on a Friday night. It's Reema Ahmed in for Stephen Nolan, and it's time for the news.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
With the BBC News at 11 o'clock, this is Jason Kay. The lawyers representing some of the women who've accused Mohammed Al-Fayed, the former Harrods owner, of rape and sexual assault, have laid out shocking details of the case. At a news conference, they described how Mr. Al-Fayed, who died last year, had set up a system in which young women were recruited so he could assault them. Mr. Al-Fayed also owned Fulham Football Club between 1997 and 2013, and a former manager of the club's women's team has told the BBC that extra precautions were put in place to protect female players from him. Here's our sports news correspondent, Laura Scott.
For Gota Haugeners, who managed Fulham's women's team from 2001 to 2003, the allegations about Mohammed Al-Fayed have not come as a surprise. He said that members of staff at the club became aware that the late billionaire liked young blonde girls, and during his time there had been extra precautions in place so that female players were never left alone with the billionaire. Fulham issued a statement saying they were deeply troubled and concerned by the disturbing testimony from several women alleging that they were sexually abused used at Harrods by Mohammed Al-Fayed, and were trying to establish whether anyone at the club had been affected.
The UN Security Council is discussing the crisis in the Middle East after 4 days of intensive Israeli attacks on Hezbollah. The UN human rights chief said he was appalled by the explosion of thousands of pages and walkie-talkies in Lebanon, which he said could be a war crime. Israel's ambassador said Hezbollah's actions had violated international law and the country wouldn't allow its people to live under constant threat. The Independent Office for Police Conduct, which is investigating police actions after the Hillsborough disaster, has apologised to bereaved families and survivors for causing them distress. Letters the police watchdog sent out to some of the people whose complaints it's investigating had been described as abhorrent, degrading and cruel. The Hillsborough survivor, Val Yates, was one of those who received a letter.
The letter came out of the blue and it didn't really say anything about the police conduct other than that the complaint wasn't going to be upheld and the letter was more a dissection of my original statement and they effectively told me that I was lying. It was a real stab in the heart. It made me feel that we were being blamed all over again.
The US Secret Service.